This is winter program. And this this is Monday morning of the fourth week. And the topic is the theology of evangelism. The reason I think we're looking at this topic is because the chapter in Call to Conversion is called The Betrayal. And it really reflects the problem with evangelism, and especially in what we call the evangelical churches. And we thought, as a supplement to this chapter, it would be good to just talk about the meaning of evangelism in our lives and in our tradition, and therefore talk about a theology of evangelism. But I'd be interested, just at the very beginning, what comes to your mind when you see the word evangelism? Is it negative or positive, or is it, do you have pictures that come to your mind? Billy Graham. The revival tents. Revival tents?
Emotions.
Church evangelism. Has anyone here served on a church evangelism committee? Okay. What was it like? Our committee usually planned the coffee hours after. So some of you, evangelism just brings a memory of what we call a church evangelism committee. What about some others?
Preachers with southern accents,
long sideburns, and they always have floppy Bibles. Hold over your hands and you hold them. These are some stereotypes that are coming forth right now, including my own. Anybody else? Evangelism.
Knocking
door to door. Going door to door. And what would you do when you go door to door? Did you ever go door to door? Oh, you never got caught. You never got caught having to do that. Okay.
My dad was just on an evangelism committee, and they had to take a census of all the people that were involved in churches.
Oh, a community census to kind of see the religious situation of a neighborhood or a community. Mm-hmm. I was all in 10 of my 15 years in the parish ministry, I was associate pastor or assistant pastor, which means you're second. And that means you always get the evangelism committee.
That says something.
Because there's something about an evangelism committee. Well, it's hard because nobody quite knows what it is. Anybody else? I want to give an example now of some what I think is authentic evangelizing, or a person being evangelized, and then called Beginning to Pray. It's Anthony Bloom. Do you pronounce it Bloom, Mary? Do you know? Bloom. And Anthony Bloom is the Russian Orthodox bishop. And the book is mainly a book about contemplation and prayer. But the beginning is an interview with Anthony Bloom. And I want to just read about two pages of the book. And it cuts right into the middle of the interview, so you'd have to read the whole thing. But Anthony Bloom grew up in Russia, in the Russian Orthodox Church, and then in 1937 became an expatriate, meaning because of the political situation in Russia at that time, many families had to leave Russia to avoid death or to avoid imprisonment. And he was one of them, so he grew up in Paris. But he grew up as a Russian person with a real Russian identity in Paris, and eventually in France became Archbishop of the Russian Orthodox Church. I told you about him. That's what made me think of this book. The interviewer asked him, "When did you become a Christian? Was there any particular turning point?" His answer: "It came in several stages. Up to my middle teens, I was an unbeliever and very aggressively anti-church. I knew no God, I wasn't interested, and I hated everything connected with the idea of God. In spite of your father? Yes, because up to the age of 15, life had been very hard. We had no common roof, and I was at a boarding school, which was rough and violent. All the members of my family lived in different corners of Paris. It was only when I was about 14 that we all gathered under a common roof, and that was real happiness and bliss. It is odd to think that in a suburban house in Paris one could discover perfect happiness, but it was so. This was the first time that we had had a home since the revolution. But before that, I ought to say that I had met something which puzzled me a great deal. I was sent to a boys' summer camp when I was about 11 years old, and there I met a priest who must have been about 30. Something about him struck me. He had love to spare for everyone, and his love wasn't conditioned by whether we were good, and it never changed when we were bad. It was an unconditional ability to love. I had never met this in my life before. I had been loved at home, but I found it natural. I had friends too, and that was natural, but I had never met this kind of love. At the time, I didn't trace it to anything. I just found this man extremely puzzling and extremely lovable. Only years later, when I had already discovered the gospel, did it occur to me that he loved with a love that was beyond him. He shared out divine love to us. Or, if you prefer, his human love was of such depth and had such scope and scale that he could include all of us, either through joy or pain, but still within one love. This experience, I think, was a deep spiritual experience, or the first deep spiritual experience I had. And the question, what happened after this? Nothing. I went back to boarding school, and everything went on as before until we found ourselves under the same roof. When I found myself confronted with perfect happiness, a quite unexpected thing happened. I suddenly discovered that if happiness is aimless, it's unbearable. Does that make sense? Unbearable happiness? I could not accept aimless happiness. Hardships and suffering had to be overcome. There was always something beyond them. But because it had no further meaning, and because I believed in nothing, happiness seemed to be stale. So I decided I would give myself a year to see whether life had any meaning. If in the course of that year I could not find any meaning, I decided I would not live, I would commit suicide. How did you get out of this aimless happiness? I began to look for a meaning in life other than what I could find through purposefulness. Studying and making oneself useful for life didn't convince me at all. All my life up to now had been concentrated on immediate goals, and suddenly these became empty. I felt something immensely dramatic inside myself, and everything around me seemed small and meaningless. Months passed and no meaning appeared on the horizon. One day it was during Lent, and I was then a member of one of the Russian youth organizations in Paris. One of the leaders came up to me and said, "We have invited a priest to talk to you. Come." I answered with violent indignation that I would not. I had no use for the church. I did not believe in God. I did not want to waste any of my time. But the leader was subtle. He explained that everyone who belonged to my group had reacted in exactly the same way. How would you like to be this priest coming to talk? And if no one came, we would all be put to shame because a priest had come, and we would be disgraced if no one attended his talk. "Don't listen," the leader said. "I don't care, but just sit and be a physical presence." Were you ever asked to be a body? That's something. To save somebody from embarrassment. That much loyalty I was prepared to give to my youth organization, so I sat through the lecture. I didn't intend to listen, but my ears pricked up. I became more and more indignant. I saw a vision of Christ and Christianity that was profoundly repulsive to me. When the lecture was over, I hurried home in order to check the truth of what he had been saying.
I asked my mother whether she had a book of the gospel, because I wanted to know whether the gospel would support his monstrous impression I had derived from his talk. I expected nothing good from my reading, so I counted the chapters of the four gospels to be sure I read the shortest, not to waste time unnecessarily. So I started to read Mark. While I was reading the beginning of St. Mark's Gospel, before I reached the third chapter, I suddenly became aware that on the other side of my desk there was a presence. And the certainty was so strong that it was Christ standing there that it has never left me. This was a real turning point, because Christ was alive and I had been in his presence. I could say with certainty that what the gospel said about the crucifixion of the prophet of Galilee was true. And the centurion was right when he said, "Truly he is the Son of God." It was the light of the resurrection that I could read with certainty the gospel, or it was in the light of the resurrection that I could read with certainty the story of the gospel, knowing that everything was true in it because the impossible event of the resurrection was to me more certain than any event in history. History I had to believe, the resurrection I knew for a fact. I did not discover, as you see, the gospel, beginning with its first message of the Annunciation, did not unfold for me as a story which one can believe or disbelieve. It began as an event that left all problems of disbelief behind, because it was direct and personal experience. Oh, I'll stop there, but just from what I've read, what are some concepts just in that reading of what evangelism was in the life of Anthony? What were some things that happened that were authentic that led him to faith? Just from this, and was this, did this lead him to a fast conversion? No, in fact, he was a staunch atheist, but something had happened. He'd met a priest. He had met a priest that had loved him unconditionally. Do you think this had an effect, or what kind of an effect on what happened later? Do you see what that in that what that first priest did that was contrary or different than what Jim Wallace says the church doesn't do? Does that make sense, that question? All those double negatives. I'll just tell you. I mean, unconditional love is counterculture. It's totally different than the kind of the values of the world around us. And that was the first thing he really discovered, even in the midst of his intellectual atheism or agnosticism.
He also witnessed with his presence. And he doesn't say he tried to buttonhole him and ask him if he was saved and all this stuff. He was simply there with who he was, using what he had been made to be a person, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever finally use words with Anthony Bloom? Now, we got to make sure that we don't say this has to be the model of every conversion. That's the problem with the four spiritual laws. Yeah. That's supposed to be the way everybody fits in. So we don't want to go out as Anthony Bloomian evangelists, but I think there's some real authentic things happening here. Did anybody witness to Anthony with actual words? I really find two. What? Yeah.
Well, the person that got him to go hear the priest,
mm-hmm.
and the priest that made him so angry.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first, the invitation, you know, so many people are timid about evangelism, and I've felt more comfortable just telling them, why don't you just bring somebody to church, you know, or invite them to come and have their body next to yours, you know, that, well, so that did, you know, because people think, oh my goodness, I have to really be able to really articulate it. Then the second was the priest who spoke. We don't know what he said, but obviously it was extremely repulsive to Anthony. So he went home to read the shortest gospel to see if it was really as bad as the priest sounded. I'd like to hear that speech. And then,
Well, what was his father? Hadn't he heard the gospel before?
I forgot. It's been a year since I read it. I just picked this out and picked. Maybe I'll just. He was in the diplomatic corps. Yeah, because he was a very high in the diplomatic corps. But I don't know what it is about his father's personality. Yeah, I'll have to look it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, his father was a positive influence. Who was this? Now, this is one we sometimes forget. Who was the greatest verbal witness in Anthony Bloom's life? Somebody that lived 2,000 years ago, not Jesus. Who wrote the book of Mark? Mark. A human being told a story. And told a story in a way that was never meant to be a little history book, but was a living, breathing witness of Mark's encounter with Jesus and then his sharing of that encounter by writing a book. Well, it's a human witness, that in that human witness that Anthony Bloom finally met the risen Christ. So who snatched him, Christ or Mark? Finally. You know, the answer again is obvious, that it wasn't Mark having the proper manipulative technique, but somehow the living Christ met Anthony through the witness of Mark. Well, I just brought this up to kind of get our minds on what, authentic evangelism as it has happened in somebody's life. But now we want to back up and just look at some of the words. Does anybody know the background of the word evangelism? It's a public. It's really comes from the word good news. And it also, in the context of the ancient world, is a public proclamation. An example in the ancient world, we forget what it was like without television and radio and quick communication. If your city-state was at battle, maybe miles and miles away, all the townspeople that were not in the battle would be waiting over the walls and would see a runner coming in the distance. And you knew that runner knew who won the battle. But it was not till the runner was close enough to you could see his face, and then finally until the words were said, "We won," that then the town would just probably go into a tremendous celebration of victory. And it was because one person had come running down the road and made the public proclamation. Have you ever thought how much fun it would be to be that runner if you'd won? And how awful it would be if you had lost? You know, then you would have to be the bearer of bad news. But if you had won the battle, all these people are waiting and you come being the bearer of good news. Have you ever thought in your own life completely, separated from the gospel as we know it, or the message of Jesus, just some tremendous good news that happened in your life, and that you just couldn't wait to tell your friends? What would it be? I was accepted into graduate school. No, that isn't. The announcement of a birth, of an engagement, I'm going to be married. Of what would some examples be? This fabulous good news in your life. You all lost your job. I lost my job. I'm going to Holden. Little things. I remember once it was midnight and Karen and I were driving home from a meeting and we needed a quart of milk. So we stopped and had never stopped at this grocery store before, and and everybody was half asleep. They put the milk in the sack and then they said, "You want us to put one of these prize cards in?" And we never win anything. So I said, "No," and then I said, "I'll throw it in." And we got home and Karen rubbed it off and we won $100. But what was, you know, which was, you know, $100. But, but, you know, the funny thing, I couldn't wait the next day to tell everybody. You know, just to everybody I met, I said, "Guess what? We stopped at Piggly Wiggly." First time we ever stopped there. One quart of milk. $100. But just that little excitement that next day, you know, this of just a, you know, teeny good news, but it was fun. It was fun to tell. And that is the content of the word evangelism, that it's not, and our problem is we've lost that. So we have study courses on how to get yourself kind of psyched up for evangelism, and then learning the technique of how to make a house call. And I was remember going once to a very serious evangelism workshop, and one of the techniques was to always pray in your car before you go up to the door. The leader, and everybody was so serious, and the leader asked us if any of us had tried this and if it works. And my response was, "Yeah, I always pray before I get to the door. I always pray they won't be home." And instead of laughing, everybody just frowned at me in this long silence. He said, but I don't know why I brought that in, but for a minute now, I think we need to just review what we mean by just good news when we're talking about the gospel. And I would say it this way. You know, we can say it in different ways, but in a world where in so many ways life seems meaningless, where evil seems to conquer good, where hatred seems to conquer love, where violence and sickness and disaster seem to be the final word, and death seems to be the final word about life. And finally, it seems to be a place of despair where human beings are almost put here in life as a joke. And if there is a God, and as we look at life around us, and especially at hunger, children dying of hunger, most of the people in the world in situations of injustice and poverty, and then think of a creator, we almost think it must be a big joke, or some God who just wants to play a big trick. And first, you have to to feel good news, you have to feel despair of how the world looks around us. And then to say in the midst, what is that? To say in the midst of this despair that God, the really real, has entered into this world with unconditional love and embraced the world and embraced us. In a way, how can we stop from just running around saying, "Wow"? Andrew Greeley, and I read chapter 3 of Andrew Greeley about every couple of months just to remind me of how wonderful the good news is, even if Andrew Greeley is now gone from this into writing novels about fallen priests and is making all kinds of money. But I want to just read a sentence here. "The message seems to the most or the message speaks to the most fundamental questions a person can ask. Is reality malign or gracious? Do you get the question? Is reality malign or gracious? Is ultimate reality bad or good? Or is life finally meaningless? Or is life finally good? Jesus replies that it is gracious to the point of insane generosity. Is life absurd or does it have a purpose? The reply of Jesus is not only does it have a purpose, but that God has directly intervened in human events to make it perfectly clear what the purpose is. What is the nature of the really real? This is Andrew Gurley's way of saying God. He calls God the really real. Jesus' response is that the really real is generous, forgiving, saving love. And how does a good person behave? The good person is one who is captivated by the joy and wonder of God's promise. In the end, will life triumph over death or death over life? And the disciples between Good Friday and Easter were convinced that death triumphs over life. Jesus is perfectly confident the kingdom of his Father cannot be vanquished, not even by death. Well, that's a witness. Now, for those whose lives have been changed, and by changed, it doesn't mean you never have any doubts, or you never have any pain or despair, or days of faithlessness. But sometime you've responded to that good news with an aha. Then it is as natural as breathing to be a witness. And this is the second word, the word witness. And I'm really turned off sometimes by this word, because when I was in Luther League, where I always felt guilty at high school from Luther League programs for not being witnesses. And he said, oh my goodness, at least once a week I have to say Jesus to somebody. Do you know, was that ever your experience? Or was this only Luther League in the 50s?
It's not only Luther League, there are others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and by the end of the week, if I hadn't witnessed at least once, I felt like I hadn't done my duty. And it was back to another Luther League program, and somebody would talk about witnessing. Does this experience ring a bell with anybody? What is a witness, just in a secular sense? What is a witness?
Someone that testifies under oath.
Yeah.
Or someone who observes.
Yeah. It's really one who is seen and one who tells. And we're in a courtroom, right? You'd be under oath in a courtroom, but you've seen something and you tell it. That is a witness. In the early church, witness came to have a very specific meaning. It was someone who died for the faith. A martyr was called a witness in the early church. Now let's look at this question. Some people, or it's very common and very common in the church, that we shouldn't be witnesses. Because a common response is that religion is a private affair and somebody else's religion is their business. And this carries on to missions. People that live in other cultures have their religion, so we shouldn't bother them with ours. They're happy with theirs. So therefore we say evangelism is maybe for a few people that want to do that, and that's why we have evangelism committees, but it's not something everybody needs to do or should do. I don't know. How do you respond to that?
Wouldn't it be nice?
Is it the very nature of our hearing the gospel to also tell the gospel? Or do you think it's a private matter and everybody should be?
I think it's a private matter. Hmm. What were you going to say, Kathy?
That I just had mixed feelings about it, because in the Bible it says, go out there, speak it to all the nations and all that kind of thing. And maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but that tells me that it is a public matter. If you have the good news, you should tell it. But then I also fight with, boy, who am I to go into a culture and tell them that their life is wrong and that my life is better? And kind of like back to the imperialization of America onto other cultures and things.
Yeah, could you also say that to a personal imperialization?
Uh-huh.
It's really to walk up to another person's life and saying, your life is incomplete, mine is, I'm going to dump this on you. Would that be similar to what we say about missions?
Right.
I mean, to live...
To live the distinctive lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that means not being verbal about it until... Mm-hmm.
The
chance comes up fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That relates to the story of Bloom. You know, it was the alternative lifestyle that touched him first, and then someone came at the right time with the words.
Yeah. Then your examples of incidents where you've really been excited by some people, some good news, and doesn't that make you try to tell you that? Well,
if you equate
that
with the good news of the gospel, doesn't that excite us? I agree with Kathy saying it was good, but then if you put it in the light of those examples, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. The gospel doesn't do for us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have any of you been the object of an evangel that has really turned you off?
What
happened and what dynamics were going on that really made you upset? And sometimes that turns us against all evangelism. What was happening there when somebody came up to you in a way that... They didn't listen. They had all the answers. Did you feel this person really cared about you? Tom Boyd calls it head-hunting evangelism. You know, you have a quota for the week of heads, you know, and also different categories that are more important prizes. You know, if you can come back and you got a Jew, you know, that is... Remember, Tom Boyd is a professor at the University of Oklahoma that lectures on evangelism in a very beautiful, positive way, and it's also a comedian, you know, and he will dance across the stage during his lecture and hold up his hand and say, look, I got a Jew. You know, and that is the greatest prize, you know, for this type of evangelizing. But what I'd like to do now before I do that, I'd like to just invite you to share. Just like Anthony Bloom could look back on his life, and we were just there talking about negative witnesses. But every one of us has positive witnesses in our life, people who have shared unconditional love, have shared something that brings the gospel home to us, have said something that has really contributed either to our conversion or to our faith development. And these are the positive witnesses in our lives. And I'd like to just ask you just to, you probably know I'm going to do this, so here it comes. Just turn to one other person next to you and just share one person that has been meaningful. Maybe it's not even a Christian. Maybe it's someone that God worked through in spite of the fact that they weren't what we call a believing Christian, but just somehow God came to you through that person. And then, so share that with one other person, and then we'll think about what are some of the characteristics of these. I'll even find one because I want to tell about Julia Kinsel. And always the fun at Holden, we all stay together so you can keep talking about this. And then
But what are just, without retelling your stories to the whole group, let's just share either from what you said or what you heard somebody say, what are some characteristics of people? One thing I forgot to say at the beginning, a lot of times we're equally influenced by people we've never met, you know, like St. Mark, or I know for me in seminary it was Bonhoeffer that I'd never met but was deeply moved by his life. You know, but you probably talk more about people you had known. But just what were some of the characteristics? Or maybe even write them down.
What? Did somebody say something?
No, I thought I heard a noise coming.
Self-giving love.
Self-giving love. One I had was listening.
Caring.
Constancy.
And?
Would that be like being consistent, like always?
No.
Having
a constant Christian presence.
Doesn't mean you'd be consistently perfect.
Not condemning.
Self-control and discipline.
Did anybody say the person you met was perfect, morally perfect?
I haven't met it personally, but I've heard a lot about it.
Yeah. Confessional?
What do you mean by confessional?
They were able to relate to problems and stuff. That's
good. They were able to what?
They related to problems that I had.
Oh, I see. Hmm. Yeah. Oh, in terms of confession and forgiveness and being, yeah. I found, too, with mine is a sense of, I guess I'd call it this way, a shared weakness. And part of the reason for doing this is just to help us affirm, sometimes if you read Jim Wallace's chapter, you say you almost can feel nothing is happening. You know, in spite of the fact of what he says, and I think what he says is very real, that the church is not living a counterculture existence. People in the church, because a lot of these things are kind of counterculture, and they're the kind of things that have helped us come to the faith. Now, I want to move from there now to what this is about, is to show you a theology of evangelism. And then you'll see how I think really this fits into it. I think our theology of evangelism is consistent with our whole theology. And I want to just show you two different ways of looking at the whole faith and the whole world, in fact, the whole universe. And then I think from that you'll see that there are two very different ways of evangelism. And I don't have names for these, I just have charts. The first one is would be to look at the world and all the people in the world as total darkness, and for God is not present. Okay, within this world of total darkness are the Christians. And now this is a little different than my bubbles. Okay, you might say, how could you have the bubbles, or you kind of agree with this and now you disagree with it? But if you want to ask me that at the end, I'll try to explain. But here's a Christian, and the Christian has the light in the world of total darkness, and the Christian has the answers.
Okay, so when a Christian confronts somebody out here, it's really like a Christian is one who is Christ in him, and then the person you're talking to is one that's just an empty nothing. And the purpose is to shove into this other person what you got, because this person really has nothing. And it's from this theology, see, we get the feeling when a person like this talks to us. And the world of darkness is not only non-Christians, it's also Christians you don't agree with. And we had, in Albuquerque, there were Baptist churches, and I'm just using that denomination because that happened there, because it could be the other way, but Lutheran and Roman Catholic and Episcopalian churches were darkness to be evangelized. And they would never make any distinction between a person that was totally unchurched and a Lutheran. Either one was in darkness. And therefore, you only have something to give, and this person has nothing to give back. You have nothing to receive because you have truth. And you can use all kinds of words. You have truth, and this is error. Darkness, light, the true faith, all the false faiths. Be in the light as you are. Now I want to show what is a very different understanding of evangelism, and what for me can become a very authentic evangelism. Because I don't, to me this isn't. Because I've been the object of this kind of evangelism. The first feeling I have is that when I meet this person, I'm down here looking up, and this person is up here looking down. You know what I mean? This person has everything, I have nothing. And this, what I want to show is this is really based on your understanding of the whole world. Because a person like this will also be part of a Christian group or church group that sees everything outside of the church group as darkness. And therefore, you have to have your own culture. You have to have your own radio stations. You have your own stores. You have your own books. You have your own novels. You have your own movies. You have your own radio stations. You have a whole subculture going on, because outside of your culture is complete darkness. And part of the reason for never going to movies is that that's the world out there, and it's completely dark. And you don't have anything to do with that except to reach out and rescue people out of that and bring them in. Now, I'll look at it a different way, and that, again, think of this as a whole world, and that God is active in all creation. So, okay, say, here's me, here's our church group, whatever, and we have experienced the gospel, and we celebrate the gospel. We celebrate the good news of Jesus Christ. But when we look out at the world, we see a world where God, through the Holy Spirit, we would say, is just active every place. So when I meet another person who is not specifically a Christian or specifically part of my intentional Christian community, I stand before that person in awe, realizing that God has been working in the life of that person long before this person ever met me. Is that humbling? If God is active in the whole world, God has been working in that person's life. So now, how I relate to that person then is this way. This chart really comes out of a whole school of evangelism that's kind of taken place, especially in the LCA, called Word and Witness. I don't know if any of you have been in a Word and Witness program. I think it's one of the most authentic things the church has done. But when you understand the whole world this way, then you realize that I have a story. This is the story of my life. All the things that have happened in my life, all the pains, all the sorrows, all the sadness, and yet all the joys, all of the mistakes, all of the sins, all of the forgiveness, all of the mercy, all of the weakness, all of the goofs, and just everything that my life is and my life altogether is a story. And within this story, to have faith is to see God working within my story. So what you have then is, as Christians, we also say that God has a story. God's story is the story of Scripture. God's story is God coming to the earth in Jesus, dying on a cross, being raised. This is God's story. And for me to be a Christian is for God's story to somehow be the story of my life. The death of Jesus being my death, the resurrection of Jesus being my resurrection, to see my life as death and resurrection, God's story becomes my story. Okay, then when we meet another person, we meet a person who also has a story. And now what a love is in a relationship that can develop between myself and that person in relationship. And this is when we each feel loved, is when we really share our stories. So a person who's, when we see ourselves as an evangelist, now we meet another person not to say, let's see what I can dump on you. Yeah, Mary.
Yeah, this is picky, but I think you're doing exactly what we do in our creed and what Jim Wallace is talking about in that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You said God's story is his birth, his death, his resurrection. And I think we understand it to be more, but I think we tend to do that so often, forgetting the mm-hmm. teaching them to observe all that God has commanded us in the life of Jesus how to live.
Yeah, I think... No, I think I should not have left that out, that God's story would also be how God is acting in the world today, in justice, you know, in peace, you know, in bringing life out of death, you know, and then as that, you know, that story becomes the church's story. You know, do you think that?
Yeah, just those 3 years of Jesus' ministry so often don't even get mentioned, and I think it's part of the gospel is his birth, death, and resurrection.
Yeah, and you leave out the whole, you know, right. I agree. And I think, you know, I catch, you know, and I think maybe that's part of the problem with even the church's program in using this. And I think Jim Wallace is really right here. So let's keep thinking how not to forget that, because it's central. Do you know what we're talking about? That, you know, God's story is not only the Jesus dying and being raised, but also the teaching of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount, God working in the world today through peace, through the movement towards justice. This is all God's story. And to be a Christian is, and what Jim Wallace is really saying, the Christian church, when it's authentic, is when that whole story becomes the church's story. Rather, what Jim Wallace is really talking about is the church adopting culture's story, or America's story, right? Because there's just as we say there's my story, there's also an American story, what we talked about last week.
What did you say about the church in relation
to that? Well, what Jim Wallace is really accusing the church, and I think rightly, is that we've adopted America's story. And that's a story of power, that's a story of winning, that's a story of success,
To follow a story means to adopt that story into your own life. And maybe we've used the words of God's story while the real life of the church has been America's story. Now, back to this. Now, when I meet another person, a really love relationship with that person happens when we finally, through a mutual acceptance, can share stories in a way that's totally accepting, where that person doesn't feel like I'm only hearing the story long enough until I can change that person. And I think this is the biggest test of our Christian love, is that if you look at Jesus, he never really forced anybody to change. Can you think of any place where he did? And we call that manipulation, or it's a way of violence, of doing violence to another person. But then in the context of that kind of sharing, where there's no agenda of changing that other person, it is in the context of that relationship that the verse in Peter really comes out. Have reverence for Christ in your hearts, honor him as Lord, be ready at all times to answer anyone who asks you to explain the hope that is in you, but do it with gentleness and do it with respect. Isn't that a powerful verse? Do it with gentleness and respect. But then it's really telling a person that where there's a trust of what is the hope that is within. Now, one thing about this verse that is important is this: the hope in the individual person or the hope in the church? And this verse is often taken out of its context, and this really fits into Jim Wallace. The exact context of this verse is Peter telling the church to return evil with good, to live nonviolently in a violent world, to live peacefully in a world, to respond with good when you are confronted with evil. And so when this verse is picked out of that, we think of the hope that is in me is just kind of, oh, the hope of heaven or what? But you see how it fits into a whole life, the whole life of the church. Do you see the difference between these two styles? And it really changed me in my visitation as a pastor, because before about 1978, when the church was talking this way, when I made calls, it was usually to call on people and tell them about our youth program, or to explain to them how good our nursery was so they could be very comfortable during the worship services and not worry about their kids. It was advertising. And when the church started talking this way, and I started figuring out to go into a home and just start listening to the person's story of what held their life together or what wasn't holding it together, and then let them hear my story and let that be a witness, and to actually start using the word Jesus Christ in a conversation, which even as a pastor I'd been embarrassed to do. But I found in this context, it was real and it was authentic. And now, what time is it? 9:55. Tom.
But what happens though in a society where the story of people in the church largely isn't any, there's really no distinction between our story and the rest of the world? I mean, what is it that is unique about people in the church? We don't have a story to tell that's any different from anyone else's story. So I think that's why maybe we relied on the other way of evangelism, because there's nothing that's distinctive about us.
I thought this went through, and a lot of it came from
the life of St. Francis, and he thought of himself as an evangelist. And where did he go with his evangelism? He went right to the church. That was culture. I mean, the church of St. Francis' time was worse than ours, I think. And we just support armies. They had armies. We only support violence. The church then, in the name of the church, in the name of Christ, raised their own armies to kill people. And, you know, Francis, his evangelism was not to unbaptized people out there in the heathen world. It was to the church. And I think those who have found, those who have found that God's story is the story and the church has lost that, we take that message to the church. But again, the danger always is to think, well, we have it and the church is the dumb people. And again, it has to be, and I would argue for this, it has to be in the context of trust with other people in the church. Mary?
Kind of repeating what I said before, but that's why I think it's so important that we understand what the word gospel means. And when God's story is only the birth, resurrection, and death of Jesus, I think that's half a gospel, and that's kind of what Bonhoeffer, I think, was calling cheap grace. And until we make the story more complete and include how we're to live in that, then there's not going to be any distinction. And I think that's exactly why we're in the mess we are, and it's exactly what Alice is talking about.
Mm-hmm. How do we do that?
if we are in this room, don't start being counterculture in the way we live when we leave Holden, and people see us and say, why do you live this way? Why do you eat the way you do? Why are you concerned about peace? Why? I don't think anything we can do or to go home and tell our parents something that's just going to turn them completely off. If there's a joy or a new way of seeing that brings us something in our life that other people wish they had, that's when they ask, what is it about you? Why do you live the way you do? But people whose life is not a witness can never be authentic witnesses for Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean you have to be perfect, but boy, we just buy into the system as it is.
I think part of my reason for sharing this, though, was to show that all of us have been touched by pockets within the church or somewhere that are different. And we've been pulled into that, and go on. I wanted to add this one other thing, is that some, one possible danger in reading Wallace's chapters is to think not until the church is really doing this perfectly can we start evangelizing. Or by evangelizing, really sharing our faith. But I think it has to be both talking about our faith and also, like Mary said, that we start beginning to form those pockets of a different reality. But like in Peter, people will say, well, what is, what's happening here? What's going on? And then when that question comes, what is going on, we need to grow in just being able to verbalize it. Do you find it hard to verbalize? What do you say once? What if you were in a peace movement and somebody came up and said, well, what makes you tick? What would you say?
I've noticed in myself recently, especially talking to people about coming to Holden, that there was a genuine excitement, and it seemed like somehow every conversation I got into, I'd start talking about Holden. I see that as being a real ingraining, and that becoming so much a part of my life that there's sort of a natural witness that comes out from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with what Mary says, that has to become so much part of our lives that it's evident in every conversation we get into and everything we do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to realize that for me personally, that can be a hard thing, like it's something I have to do. But it's not. It's a response, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
That there is responsibility, yes, but that the work of evangelism is not necessarily my own personal work. It's the work of the Spirit through me. So that doesn't put the whole responsibility on
me. Yeah, it's, a lot of people have lived under so much guilt over evangelism, especially people who aren't real verbal or articulate, that somehow, you know, all of them. And I know the feeling. I remember once having dinner with my old high school clique, and most of them had quit the church. Right in the middle of the dinner, somebody asked me what the purpose of the church is, and everything just got real quiet, and every face was turned to me, and I said nothing. I just kind of burped. You know, and that night, lying in bed, I thought of all the right words I should have said. You know, and a lot of, I think we've had that laid on us sometimes, especially for people that aren't verbal. And that's why it's encouraging to know that most of the evangelism that's happened in our lives have been people who have loved us. Right? And the words are very secondary.
I would agree with that too, that much more is communicated by our presence and our actions than what was said.
And I think, you know, and Jim Wallace is just talking of what we've experienced in personal relationships, the vision that could be the whole church. I've been influenced by people who love, you know, imagine a church that loved the world. I've been influenced by people who listen to me, imagine a whole church that listens to the world. I've been deeply influenced by people who are nonviolent, imagine a whole church that teaches nonviolence and peace. Well, that's his vision of the church.
Yeah. I have a bit of a problem in, you know, my own my situation and my thinking that there's a lot more Christianity than what can be, I guess, proved or understood. And this, it comes through experiences where it was not pushed on me. It was my questioning, my going to people with the question because I saw a different way of life and was curious. But, for example, someone you feel very strongly toward and you provide the best Christian witness in this sort of a setting that you can, and you are not able to speak to them through that. I can't, as important as Christianity should be, I guess, as I read in the Bible, I can't see myself just sitting back and saying, well, let them come to it in their own time, and in the meantime, just suffering. So. And I would tend to take more of an active evangelizing, quote unquote, action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one difference between these two ways is one tends to see evangelism as my job, that I have to do it and I have to succeed. And the other tends to see evangelism as, I might share and be one person along the way, but in a way, it's a trust that God is working in the whole world and is working in this person's life. and I'm only an instrument that might be part of that. You know, it's a certain relaxing. Luther had that. I think John is quoted when some of the reformers actually took the sword to spread their reformations because they had to succeed so much. And Luther's response was, our reformation spreads by God while Melanchthon and I drink our beer. Somehow it was out of their hands. It was.
I guess I think that I've also met a lot of good, caring, listening people that haven't professed Christ in their lives, and I think it's important that we also have a verbal witness. When people do ask us, that we do understand that we give the glory to Him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there is a real difference, and it will call us to be prepared to be a witness to Him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if we had another session on this, I would have you start practicing. And with trying not to be manipulative, but just, you know, have you share your story.
Jack's got a five-session thing, isn't
he,
Jack?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well, I should.
Yeah,
I
that's good.
Maybe not
to
take five sessions on it, maybe people
agree
with
just
five sessions.
Dan, do you think there should still be evangelism committees in churches?
It's interesting. I read a survey was done that among churches that have evangelism committees and that don't, and the ones that don't had more church growth. I mean, if you're going to measure it by that. I think the mistake in the church is we call them evangelism committees when they should be just called something else.
Like,
membership advertisement committees or something. or church advertisement committees. You know, they should be called what they do.
Shouldn't all aspects of the church, whether or not that's eight different committees, I mean, shouldn't they all have an evangelical component?
Yeah, it's like peacemaking committees in the church when the church is a peace movement. You know, the whole church also is a mission movement.
I'm interested where the room is then for some global evangelism. It seems like it has to be sort of a one-on-one basis, you know, that you're sharing about a close friend.
Mm-hmm.
And how has that gone across the continents here, et cetera?
Oh, you mean the whole question of world missions? And I don't know if this is really answering that question, but the two models I showed you have also been the models of world mission as Christian faith goes into another culture. Is this a culture where it is only under the devil, or has Christ been working in this culture? And the word of Christ might simply fulfill what these people have. I don't know if that answers that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we could have another session just to show two different, because a lot of times our negative feelings about missions have been the fact that when missionary work has been carried under the one understanding of how God is at work in the world.